Air Development Center in New Mexico, a rocket-propelled sled is made ready. With an Air Force officer in the seat, the sled, powered by 9 rockets, will race along its tracks at a speed of more than 600 miles an hour. The officer, Lieutenant Colonel Stapp, has been the guinea pig on many such tests, but none at such an incredible speed. He wears no special uniform for the run, which simulates the effects experienced by pilots bailing out from supersonic aircraft. The sirens have sounded the warning, and all is set.
His work has led to probably millions of lives being saved without us even knowing it.
The slow-motion camera records Stapp's run. Within 5 seconds, he's traveling at 632 miles an hour, a new land speed record by more than 200 miles an hour.
The tests he was doing were extremely dangerous, and the reason he chose to experiment on himself was simply that he feared what would be the consequence to his own ethics, so to speak, if a person was killed or gravely injured doing an experiment that he had authorized. And so for him, there was just absolutely no choice. He had to do these experiments on himself.
Water breaks bring the sled to a halt within a second and a half.
In his own mind, he was upholding the Hippocratic Oath and doing what a physician must do, which is to benefit humanity. And I think he really viewed himself as just one person who could impact the lives of millions of people, and that's exactly what he did.
It's very likely that 400 of you will be injured in your cars tomorrow. You'll be within 6 miles of home and doing less than 30. And
it's going to happen. 20 years before the Central Office of Information was catapulting realistic-looking mannequins through the windows of Ford Cortinas, John Stapp was a real-life crash test dummy. Not just once, but repeatedly, the American Air Force colonel strapped himself into a rocket-powered sled to study the effects of deceleration on the human body.
Trick every trip.
His heroic self-experimentation made aircraft and cars safer. Stapp expert Nick Spark.
We all take it for granted when we get into our automobiles today that we put on our seatbelt, and I don't think people ask themselves, where did this come from? We just take it as a matter of course, but when Dr. Stapp first got into the field, there was no such thing as an automobile safety restraint. And it's really as a direct result of his, not only his research, but then his tireless lobbying for improvements in automobile safety features that we have those. And most people wouldn't encounter this, but a great deal of his research was directed at ejection seats from aircraft, and he really pioneered a lot of the data that was used to develop those types of systems.
Nick Spark. But is what was justifiable in the right stuff post-war America still justifiable today? Is being a guinea pig in your own experiments good science, or are there practical and ethical reasons why, when we ask who goes first, scientists should be at the back of the queue, observing, not participating?
Now, this is a prototype robot hand. We can see the fingers opening and closing and the thumb opening and closing. Now, as part of the experiment with my nervous system, I went across to New York, to Columbia University, and we put my nervous system live on the internet and connected it back to this robot hand here in Reading in the UK. So literally what happened, my brain signals, my neural signals, down my nervous system, across the internet, out to the hand here in Reading, and as I opened and closed my hand in New York, my brain signals also opened and closed this robot hand in Reading. And when the hand gripped an object, just as they're doing now, so signals went back from the fingertips of the robot hand across the internet, literally to stimulate my brain in New York. So I was controlling what my brain was quite happy was another hand of mine, as it were, a robot hand, because I could feel how much force the robot hand was applying on another continent. So then I felt enormously powerful. Here we had extended the human nervous system across the internet, and my body was, if you like, 3,500 miles long. You can be in one place, but your physical things that you can move and control can be somewhere completely different, and your senses don't have to be on your body. They can be somewhere completely different.
Kevin Warwick, Professor of Cybernetics at the University of Reading, is a firm believer in the value of self-experimentation. so much so that he volunteered to undergo neurosurgery to make the experiment just described possible.
And this is the Mad Lab, Mobile Autonomous Devices Laboratory, or MAD in the other sense. Like you put a 3-pin electrical plug into a socket, I had 100 silicon pins of a micro scale, so very, very small, but these were fired into the nervous system in my left arm. So if we look here, we can see there's still scars from the operation. It's about a 2-inch scar there where surgeons opened up my arm, exposed the median nerve fibres, which are the main bunch of nerves that run down from your brain to your hand, and fired 100 electrodes into their little mechanical hammer. In they went. And then there were wires from that running up the inside of my arm, and they came out here. So we're up a few inches away from my elbow. And on out there, there was a little connector pad, which essentially was exposing my nerves electrically to, well, whatever, the outside world. And I wore a little gauntlet thing, which I'm putting on now, and this connected up to the wires coming out of my arm, and in this, well, it looks a bit science fiction-y, sort of little gauntlet, as it'd probably be from the Terminator or something. Well, in fact, this sent signals from my nervous system by radio to the computer, and also received signals from the computer to stimulate my nervous system.
At Loughborough University, Professor Jim Horn and his colleagues are looking into the effects of sleep deprivation on human performance. Whilst conceding that much of what we know about sleep came from self-experimenters like Nathaniel Kleitman, Horn questions its validity in a modern context, particularly in studies with a psychological component.
The problem is when you do experiments on yourself, start looking at your own behaviour and psychology, you can actually produce what you want and you can distort things. That's why this is not really good science. But so really, I think when it comes to matters of the mind and matters of behaviour and psychology, it's very difficult to do things on yourself because you can bias results, because you can actually generally produce what you want.
And in that sense, is self-experimentation a bad idea because you are your own worst judge, if you like?
No, I think self-insight is very important for scientists, for actually giving the, aha, that's interesting, what can we do about that? But then to carry out a scientific experiment on yourself in the light of what you think is happening, that's the wrong thing to do. But I think the aha experience and the insight certainly comes from observation, and that is good science. But the good science then is then to take it into a more objective setting, into the laboratory, and examine it that way, rather than say, well, I'm going to try some experiments on myself, if these are more mind-oriented experiments.
Mm. But if they're not mind-oriented experiments, if they're physiological rather than psychological, you see no real problem with self-experimentation, because it's harder to skew blood sugar changes or some other physiological difference.
Up to a point, but one of my titles is I'm Professor of Psychophysiology, so I look at the effect of the mind on the body. And although we think that bodily function is not controlled by the mind, in certain circumstances it is. So we can perhaps start looking at hormone changes and changes in various constituents of the blood in ourselves as a result of some psychological state. But believing that the mind doesn't affect our body, but it can do. I can start thinking about something exciting now, and I know my heart will start increasing, my heart rate will increase, my blood pressure will go up, my adrenaline levels will go up. So I can influence my body physiology by my state of mind quite easily. So there's always an inherent worry that although perhaps physiology seems to be something which is divorced from the mind, a lot of it isn't.
They are sort of practical reasons why self-experimentation might be a bad idea. Are there any ethical objections to it, do you think?
Well, I think so. In the sense that if you were to present yourself to the university authorities, say, I want you to do this experiment on myself, they say, not likely. And you mustn't do it because even though you wish to do it in yourself, in your own body, your insurance at this university doesn't cover you doing this sort of thing, and you would be prohibited from doing it. So I guess if you wish to carry out some invasive experiment or stick some needles in yourself or take blood samples or whatever, then really you have to keep quiet about it.
Keeping it quiet to avoid falling at the ethical hurdle is exactly what Professor Peter Hall and his colleague David Lane did when they cooked up an experiment over a pint in a Dundee pub. It was back in the late 80s, and as part of their research into cancer, they wanted to know whether the protein P53 was produced in human tissue as a response to damage.
The obvious experiment that we designed was to take experimental animals to irradiate them or to give them various toxic compounds that cause DNA damage, and then we could measure in their tissues at various time points afterwards the levels of P53, and this would then tell us whether our idea was correct. But there was a problem, and that problem was that, quite rightly, the Home Office expects that animal experiments are done under quite stringent rules and regulations. To get a new animal license to do those classes of experiment was going to take many months. And we were working in a very competitive field, and being second doesn't count. So maybe one or other of us went to the bar and bought another beer and came back, and we threw some ideas around, and eventually the idea emerged that we would do it on ourselves. Before the experiment was done, we took a biopsy from one arm, my own arm, and that was put in liquid nitrogen for subsequent studies. That was the control. I then had my arm, or a patch of my arm, irradiated with ultraviolet light, equivalent to, if you like, 15 minutes on a summer's day on the beach. A little bit of erythema, a little bit of redness, a little bit of sunburn. And at various times after that, further biopsies were taken, and we could do biochemical and molecular analyses on those samples of my skin, and ask the question, do we see an induction of P53 protein in a time-dependent manner? And the answer was yes. And that was the first demonstration of a physiological induction of the P53 pathway in an organism. Before that, it was all tissue culture, and we wanted to show that it was a real phenomenon in a real organism.
And you have the scars to prove it.
Indeed I do.
Yes, they are.
There's the biopsies.
So there's the control scar towards your wrist on your right arm, and then further up, just sort of below the elbow, if you like, or the underarm, are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, or 8 scars. Quite livid still all these years later. So
8 millimetre punch biopsies done by a very careful dermatologist, yes.
8 millimetres in diameter?
Yeah, and about 4 millimetre deep.
Had it not been competitive, had the animal route been open to you more quickly, would you have not put your arm forward literally for this experiment?
Why would I bother? It was about competition that drove us to do that experiment.
Was that a wise thing to do, do you think? Was competition forcing you to do something that you wouldn't have preferred to do? Or
We didn't think it was a big deal, in that it was a little bit of sunburn and some small biopsies. It was relatively trivial, given that we thought that the question was of sufficient importance.
And you didn't want to be second with the answer to that question?
Yeah. People cite our paper, other people have done similar experiments since, and their work is not cited as often. And citation is what drives science.
And what about the ethical dimension? Was that something that concerned you? Did we live in a slightly less ethically driven scientific world then than we do now, 20 years later?
At the time, it never occurred either to David or I that this had an ethical dimension. We just did it. It subsequently transpired in conversations with the chair of the ethics committee in the hospital that I worked that I probably should have sought ethical approval. And in fact, having had that conversation, I did ask the chair of the ethics committee, would I have got approval? And he, perhaps flippantly, maybe he was speaking honestly, said, no, I wouldn't have got approval. So I said, I'm glad I didn't ask.
But it doesn't invalidate the science?
Oh, not at all.
One of the heroes of self-experimentation is Joseph Goldberger, a physician in the Midwest of the US in the early 20th century. And he, in particular, investigated a condition called pellagra. It was known by doctors as causing the three Ds, dermatitis, diarrhea, and dementia.
Dr. Tilly Tansey is reader in the History of Medical Sciences at University College London. Leafing through old journals, she says, shows that self-experimentation was commonplace. In this example, the conventional wisdom was that pellagra was caused by some kind of infectious agent.
Goldberger wasn't convinced by this because going to institutions where patients with pellagra were often confined when they had got to the demented state, he realised that although patients often got pellagra, the staff didn't. So he decided to investigate a little more. And what he did was he had a colleague inject him with the blood of a patient with pellagra to see that if there was an infectious agent and if he would develop the disease. He didn't, so he went a little further, and this is where it gets really quite disgusting. He then had capsules made that he filled with the skin cells, the urine and the faeces of patients with pellagra, and these he swallowed, and he still didn't get pellagra. So this led on to further experiments about what was happening, and he did narrow it down to the fact that it was a component that he found initially in yeast, which we now know is part of the vitamin B complex, niacin, that is absent in pellagra. That is the absence of that component that causes this disease, and that was due entirely to Goldberger's, initially his self-experimentation.
Of course, Goldberger wasn't shackled by legal and ethical barriers. He was essentially working on his own, beholden to no one, in a way that the big science we do today, collaborative, transnational, and funded by organisations with a lot to lose, clearly is. But Dr. Tansey fears science may be the poorer for it, a view shared by Professor Peter Hall. First, Dr. Tansey.
Medical research has shown that having a variety of different techniques, a certain latitude in allowing people to do what they think is important in experimental work has led to some astonishing discoveries. Obviously, we live in a much more regulated age and a much more legalistic age, but certainly a lot of experiments really up until the 1970s and 1980s and the number of advances that have been made and drugs that have been produced have come about not because people have set out to find something, but because they've seen something unusual and had the freedom to develop their ideas and explore a little further.
If you had your time over again, would you do it in exactly the same way?
No question. Absolutely no question.
You wouldn't approach the ethics committee?
No.
It hurt a little, but it was worth the pain.
Yes, and of course, in some respects, I was fully informed. I knew what was going on. And let's put it in context. We're not talking here about some life-threatening process. A little bit of sunburn and a couple of biopsies. Essentially trivial.
If there was a case where a scientist wanted to do something that was less trivial, but perhaps was of greater personal risk, would the argument be any different? If they couldn't find somebody who they could, with their hand on their heart, experiment on, or the animal option was closed to them for ethical or scientific reasons, would you say to a scientist, well, if you're prepared to take the risk, then take it, because it helps the onward march of knowledge, of progress?
I think it's difficult to answer that in a black and white manner. Case by case, it will depend upon the circumstances. It will also depend upon how important the question is. If the question is of crucial importance, if the question has, for example, something to do with, let's say, a new immunisation strategy for some lethal illness, then it may be that the potential benefit outweighs the potential risk. So I don't think you can ever paint it in a black and white manner. It will be case by case, considering the relative risks and the relative benefit to society.
Professor Peter Hall. His cost-benefit analysis approach would allow perhaps the most famous self-experiment of recent times. A decade before Hall was giving himself sunburn, in Australia, Barry Marshall was swallowing a foul-tasting bacterial brew. With his colleague, Robin Warren, he wanted to prove that stomach ulcers were caused by Helicobacter pylori. It was work that confounded a sceptical medical establishment, eventually led to a Nobel Prize, and, says Hall, proves the ethical case.
Is it ethical to stop scientists such as those from doing particular pieces of work? Consider that they hadn't done that work in the early 1980s. Consider that the discovery of Helicobacter pylori as the causative agent of stomach ulcers would have been delayed for 5 or 10 years. Think of the untold human suffering that would have occurred because of that, because of the ability now that we understand that we can eradicate Helicobacter pylori with a simple course of antibiotics. All sorts of people would have suffered had that research been delayed. Would that have been ethical?
Firstly, no ethics committee ever invented just shrugs its shoulder. It wants to have an opinion on everything, be that positive or negative. And secondly, it would probably be engaged with health and safety at work regulations. So there would be a question. You can't do just anything to yourself. Your employer has a duty of care to you.
Richard Ashcroft is Professor of Biomedical Ethics at Queen Mary University. The problem, he says, is that there's no mention of self-experimentation in the Department of Health guidelines. So any application to conduct such an experiment would have to be judged as if it involved a third party.
We don't allow people to ask others to take certain kinds of risk, even if those people appear apparently giving free consent to that. There are certain kinds of risk we don't allow people to take, even if they want to. And so the self-experimenter, if it goes above a certain threshold of risk, is in no different a position. They're asking themselves to do something stupid, and our job is to protect them.
So they would fall at the ethical hurdle?
They would fall at the ethical hurdle.
And that presents us with a dilemma, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Because there might be some good science missed as a consequence of falling at that hurdle.
Yeah.
Think of the two Australian doctors,
yes,
and their experiment with Helicobacter pylori.
Yes. And an experiment like that, you could imagine that it wouldn't get very far if they'd asked anyone's permission, because it didn't seem to fit with the received scientific wisdom of the day. So the peer review of the science would say, this is a silly idea. And then the ethics committee would say, well, the peer review of the science says it's a silly idea, so you can't do it.
Yet it's made the lives of many thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in the intervening years immeasurably better. It undoubtedly saved lives.
Absolutely right. And there are lots of other examples as well. Equally, there are many examples of where self-experimentation has produced misleading results or was actually wildly mistaken or led to serious harm to the scientists. And so we don't know in advance. That's the essential paradox of science, isn't it? So you can wonder whether there isn't a degree of irrational risk aversion in all this. Sometimes people should just be allowed to take chances, and sometimes it's by taking chances that we make progress. The difficulty is that sometimes taking chances just is stupid. and the people who are charged with writing guidelines or providing ethical oversight to these things are in a difficult position, because oftentimes it's very difficult to draw the line between the taking a risk is just daft, if you like, the jackass approach to doing science, and the cases where taking a risk is actually a rather brave and intelligent thing to do.
So is there a case, do you think, to be made for the Department of Health having some guidelines on self-experimentation?
Yeah, I think they should have something. I think it should be fairly brief and minimal, but it's better to have something written down than to have a vacuum, which then people don't know what to do when they're faced with the question, and so might be much more cautious than really they need to be, or much more gung-ho than really is wise.
So what I've got on my head at the moment is a baseball cap with ultrasonic sensors on. And what I'm doing, if I move my hand closer to one of the sensors, we can hear the buzzing noise getting a bit louder, which is giving an indication of how close an object is, my hand in this case, to the ultrasonic sensor. You see, we're moving my hand further away and closer. And in this case, it's a buzzing sensation. For the experiment, this was current stimulating my brain. So as something came closer, so the frequency of current stimulating my brain increased, and I was able to use that and move around without bumping into things.
Back at Reading University's Department of Cybernetics, Professor Kevin Warwick is blurring the boundaries between science fiction and science fact. Add to the mix the public's natural fear of the unknown, and he can see why self-experimentation is a concoction that writers and filmmakers have found irresistible.
When we put signals for the first time onto my nervous system, signals going up to my brain, no one had done that before. What's the risk? No idea. I mean, we don't have a clue. I mean, I could have gone crazy.
Good heavens.
Why, Dr. Jekyll?
Hopelessly insane.
This is pure balderdash.
You're dealing with things it would be better not to mention for your own sake. There might be trouble.
I don't know that the risks are that important, because it's what your life is about. This is what you exist for. It's a bit like if you said about the Jekyll and Hyde. Now, I know that's a fictional story, but you're there as Dr. Jekyll, and you've got the liquid potion that he drunk. And the question is, would you drink it? Well, as a scientist, of course I'd drink. I mean, if I was in Dr. Jekyll's, but of course, that's what you live for.
Really, Jekyll, this is very disturbing. Such theories come dangerously close to... Well, I hesitate to think what the medical council would be forced to say.
Dr. Cortland, advanced theories are always a sore point with the medical council.
We had to get ethical approval, both in the university and from the hospital authority involved, for the surgeons to carry out the act. And they gave us one or two questions in terms of why you're using these nerve fibres and not those nerve fibres. And it's quite useful, actually. It makes you focus your attention on what are the important things we're trying to achieve with this. But far from being... sort of preventing what we were doing, they were very supportive that the possibilities both for looking at what could happen in the future, but also for helping people with disabilities, were enormous. Could this implant help people with spinal injuries? Maybe somebody who's paralyzed, could they drive their car around? Well, one of the things I did was to drive a wheelchair directly from my brain signals. So opens up the possibility for future technology like that to be used to help people in all sorts of ways.
Over now to New Mexico.
Which in a sense isn't so very different from where we started. So who does go first? It's a question that biomedical ethicist Richard Ashcroft believes researchers should consider very carefully.
At least sometimes it should be the scientist, him or herself. If it isn't, then the scientist should at least be asking why not.
A camera records this impact on the rider. The sledge is slowed down as it reaches the end of the track. No ill effects are felt by Colonel Stapp after the fastest ride on Earth.